Esther is made queen. This is Esther 2. And so this Old Testament book has so much to teach us. And I have a question. Are you a Christian? Now, I'm talking to an audience where I think I would probably get a resounding yes. And those who have believed and received Jesus Christ, that person is actually a child of God. John 1:12 tells us that. But the next question is, as a Christian, as a child of God, how faithful to God are you? Like, have you, like myself, failed God in some way? Are you failing God in some way? You know that you're not doing things nearly as well as you ought to do. The great thing is, God does not fail us. He will not fail you. Now, he does let us learn some quite uncomfortable lessons by way of our failures, but he is always faithful to his children. Jeremiah says in Lamentations 3:22, and remember, this is at a time when the people of Judah have been rebellious, idolatrous, so they failed badly, and they will learn some sad lessons. But this is what Jeremiah writes: because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. So God's faithfulness is always sure. And the primary message of Esther is God's sovereign control over the events and the plans of man, and his particular care for those who are his people, even if they have failed greatly. We saw last time that the name of God is not mentioned at all in the book of Esther. And Misler says that Esther, taken actually from Ishtar, star, has a root meaning something hidden. And so we see God hidden behind the shadows here, keeping watch over his people, and his name, that is Yahweh, actually appears acrostically, as an acrostic, at least four times. Now, what is an acrostic? It means when the first letters, like the YHWH, or however it was written in the Hebrew, are the first letters of words, one following after another. Or they might be words equidistant from each other, but you get a pattern when you look at it. Those letters could leap out like capitals. And it can be going from right to left, as the Hebrew language is, or it can be going from left to right. So it's a little bit like an acronym. You know, we talk about NATO, but we actually know that it's Northern Atlantic Treaty Organization. So you take out those letters. Now, it's not exactly an acronym, but one that I liked was one that came out. If I tell you this sentence, I received a speeding ticket because of radio airways detecting and ranging. So those first letters spell radar. So I got a speeding ticket because of radar. So an acrostic is a bit like that, but it could be coming or going and in consecutive or words that are further apart. Now, historically, the events recorded in the book of Esther took place in the 5th century BC. There were Jews scattered throughout what we call the ancient world. They'd been taken prisoners from Israel and from Judah in two captivities. The Assyrians took off the Israelites, those of the Kingdom of Israel, and then the Babylonians took off the Judahites later. And the Babylonian Empire was then conquered by the Persians, but it's just the same areas that you're covering. So people scattered here will come under the Persian rule. It reached from India to Ethiopia and northwards to the Caspian and Aral Seas. That's how far it stretched. Now, the Persian king of Esther, of this period, was Xerxes. And his father Darius had sent both his army and great navy to subdue a little part of this area that wasn't under his rule, and that was some of the independent Greek states. Tiny areas of land, but he was determined to bring them in and make them a part of his great empire. He failed. So we heard about the battle at Marathon, which he lost, and the marathon runners going to Athens and telling them that the Greeks had won. But his son Xerxes, he came back defeated to Persia and died, and his son Xerxes planned a huge campaign to conquer the Greek states and avenge his father. And so, in the final week of his great campaign, planning, briefing people, military, political people, which took 6 months with a lot of banquets and so on, he then held a special banquet for the citizens of his winter capital in Susa. And when he and all his male guests were the worse for drink, he sent for the queen, the beautiful Vashti, to present herself before this inebriated bunch of men for viewing. Now, Vashti, we don't know why she refused. We know that would be an awful thing to have to do. But she was quite possibly pregnant because her son Artaxerxes was born the same year, and she refused to come. She was not executed. That would have stirred up all kinds of political problems. But the angry king listened to his advisers, and their view was the female had to be in submission to the male, and certainly the wife to the husband, and so he dethroned Vashti and banished her permanently from his presence. And so then Xerxes, when that's happened, he's ready for this Greek campaign, and it demanded his full attention. He was gone for the next 3 years, but he came back from the battles that he had there in the Bay of Salamis and from Petraea. He was defeated. He was humiliated. The king had expended enormous amounts of money, men, his own prestige, and he'd lost. And he comes back and he's got no queen. And so no doubt, too, in those 3 years, while all that fighting's going on, back home there's all kinds of speculation and rumbling. Something had to be done. So, chapter 2, we're there. It says, later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. And it said that they may have decided there would be fewer problems with a commoner coming to the throne than if somebody was chosen from the nobility or out of the royal families. And it goes on, let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now, this was not a queen quest for eager entrance. This was a search and assess job of those commissioners who went out to inspect the virgin girls of the empire and conscript in those who best filled the requirements and bring them to Susa, whether they liked it or not. Now, some may have seen it as a favourable option to what their life would otherwise be, and they would be living in luxury. But in reality, the girl was a prisoner of the palace for the rest of her life. She was to be a sex provider for the king, and she might only come into his bed and his presence only once. And Warren Wiersbe wonders how many mothers and fathers tried to hide a beautiful daughter, a bit like Jochebed trying to hide Moses, because otherwise that daughter would be taken from them forever, and they would be, on the whole, they'd be teenagers. How many, he wonders, would have been swiftly married off to somebody else to stop them being taken away? So a conscripted version would have one night with a king, and after that she became a concubine, which had a kind of wife attachment to it, but she was definitely his forever. And we know, even from the scriptures, that the Jewish people fell into that. Solomon, with his 700 wives, so many of them married for political reasons, because if you take the daughter of some other prominent person or king or other nation, you're not going to perhaps be attacked by them because you have their daughter in the palace. But what do you do with 700? Wouldn't you forget their names even? And as well, he had, as a little boy at school said, 300 porcupines, that is, concubines. And so in verse 5, now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. So we do need to look at who Mordecai was, because this will be important. He was a Jew. He was of the tribe of Benjamin. He was the great-grandson of Kish, who was taken captive to Babylon. This would have been, 70 years before, to Babylon, along with Judah's king Jehoiachin in the second deportation. That was in 597 BC. And we can read about that in 2 Chronicles 36. But Kish is a Benjaminite name, a royal name. King Saul's father was called Kish. So Mordecai is probably a descendant in that family line, having that particular name. And we'll see later why that's important and how God works out his purposes sometimes hundreds of years later, generations later. But with his people, it's what he does. And I forget who the poet was who says, the mills of God grind slow, but they grind exceeding small. And they do. The Jews say coincidence is not a kosher word. And that's true with God. So verse 7, Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, which means myrtle, the beautiful myrtle flower, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This girl, who was also known as Esther, Persian name, was lovely in form and features, and Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. Verse 8, when the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Now, servants like Hegai were made eunuchs because that then did away with a problem of them being sexually involved with any of the women in the harem. And there were other servants in the palace likewise attending the king who would not be distracted by women or involved in any other way, but their focus would be on serving the king. And like Daniel, really, in the case of Daniel, a captive taken to Babylon, it prevented them from fathering children who might rebel against the king. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, probably the same, serving there in the palace. And we see in 2 Kings 20 and in verse 18, a prophecy of this, that in Hezekiah's day, he was king and he let all these people, ambassadors from Babylon, come and look at all the treasures of Jerusalem and the temple. And he shouldn't have done that. And afterwards the prophet said to him, that was a foolish thing to do. They will come back for all of that. And your descendants will be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. And Daniel seems to fit that role, and the others as well. And so Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge of the harem. The girl pleased him and won his favour. Immediately he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids selected from the king's palace and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Maybe that would have saved her from a lot of the cattiness that might probably go on. I look forward to meeting Esther because she must be a lovely person. Everybody liked her. Haggai liked her, so she got top treatment. But I noticed Joseph found favour in Egypt. Daniel found favour in Babylon. Esther found favour in Persia. Not one of them were arrogant. They were winsome. All were captives of a people not their own. And of course what we see here is God at work. And so he helps that they should have favour. But we notice they did not hate, they didn't complain, they were not bitter. So there is pain and suffering in this world because of sin. But it's Chuck Swindoll who says this, pain is inevitable, misery is optional. Because he says, misery is our response to pain and suffering and how we handle it. Suffering or injustice can lay us low, he says, or help us grow. So we can turn from God or we can run to God. And that's what we see happening. So, and we ourselves, we can feel crushed or defeated, but we can take the thing that God has allowed and with our hope and trust in him, make the best use of a hard situation. And I know, you remember Norman Vincent Peale, he wrote The Power of Positive Thinking. He actually said that he wanted to write a book called something like The Power of God, but his publishers said, that's not going to sell anything. We'll do The Power of Positive Thinking. And some of the things we mightn't all agree with. But he said, trouble gives opportunity for God to do great things. Our trouble. And he says, I see trouble coming down the road. I say, trouble, where have you been so long? Because I know that God is going to use it for greater good. So verse 10, Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. So they don't know she's a Jewess. Why? We don't know why they didn't say. So the scriptures often give us these facts that happen, but not reasons or motives. But as we look at it, we learn for ourselves. I believe the Holy Spirit helps us to learn what we need to learn. What we do know is that Satan is always at work and has always been to move people to hate God's people and to hate God's people, the Jews. Mordecai may have wanted to protect Esther from that, what we would call racist hate and that discrimination. And like, it's only very recently, would have only been less than 20 years that they stopped being a captive people and were, had been allowed to go back to Jerusalem. And so they would be looked down on, the foreigners, the people who'd been slaves and so on, as not as up there as the native Persians. And I wondered, was it possible too that the Holy Spirit prompted Mordecai to instruct Esther in this way because it's a key point in all that unfolds. Now some commentators criticise Mordecai and Esther who obviously were not living kosher lives. They were not keeping the dietary law, the prayer laws and so on as Daniel did. Others say, when you've come several generations on, you've never seen the temple, Solomon's temple had been destroyed, you've not participated in any of the sacrifices, there's no priests to instruct in worship practices, it's no wonder that there's a certain losing touch of the Mosaic law. But God is still their God, and that they know. They had not abandoned faith in him, and he had not abandoned them. Some say that Mordecai should have gone back to Jerusalem with Zerubbabel when permitted to do so, because this is his era. But I only know that God used them for his most excellent purposes in Persia, where they were. Matthew Henry says Mordecai may be the Mordecai in Ezra 2:2 who did go back with Zerubbabel and possibly returned to Persia when the Samaritans stopped them from going on building the temple. They couldn't go ahead, and then had young Esther to look after and bring up. We don't know those things, but I think it behooves us not to be too judgmental in our thinking of people we read about, unless the Bible says that they sinned in this, because we don't know. And so every day Mordecai walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. He had a father heart. In some way, he's a bit of a picture, isn't he, of the Father always watching over us, always there. Verse 12, before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And no doubt there was other training too, about what they were to be for the king and how to conduct themselves. And 12 months of getting used to this whole new idea, these girls being trained in these things. And verse 13, and this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go there, and in the morning return to another part of the harem to the care of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. And I say, if he could remember. So no longer a virgin, she now is in another part. She is a concubine. So verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, and we get a bit more information here, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favour of everyone who saw her. So she was a bit of a special girl. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now, the great feast when Vashti was deposed was 4 years earlier. So, 17, now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women. Some say, some versions say he loved her, but apparently the better translation is was attracted to her. And so he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Xerxes now has a Jewish queen, though he's not aware that she's Jewish. Verse 18, and the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. Apparently there are tax concessions made at such times, and some prisoners set free, as Barabbas was at Passover in Jesus' day. Now, Xerxes seems to have been pretty pleased with the new queen that he has. Nevertheless, there's another lot of virgins brought in verse 19, or after it's all this over, the ones that are left are brought in the second assembly. And by this time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Now, the officers and the law courts of a walled and fortified city were built into the walls near the gates. And here, all those coming and going are observed and checked. This is for security reasons. But here, Mordecai is employed, and he would have quite a responsible position here. Here the courts go on. He's got access to inside information. Verse 20, but Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do, for she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. And in his position, he would have access to other servants and perhaps to Haggai to take messages back and forth. And it's true that neither she, Esther, nor Mordecai lied about their nationality, but at this point did not refer to their Jewishness. They kept their own counsel. Matthew Henry makes this point. All truths are not to be spoken at all times. You don't have to tell everything. But untruths are to be spoken at no time. And we find that Mordecai has told, obviously when it came up, that he was a Jew, when we get to that. Verse 21, during the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, so they are responsible guards there, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. It was a risky business being a king, but some speculate that Vashti may have a hand behind this, particularly after all the fuss and the installation of Esther as queen. And we are told it seems as though Vashti was behind Xerxes' assassination quite a number of years down the track. But verse 22, but Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on a gallows. The gallows is not the sort of rope and noose hanging that we think of when we talk about a gallows. They were impaled on poles. And Xerxes' father, Darius, according to the historians, impaled 3,000 men through one whole incident at one time. It's pretty awful, isn't it? But awful things still go on in the world today. Mordecai had been shown loyalty to the king. So I don't know if it was risky for him to be the whistleblower, but at the time, he wasn't shown any special gratitude, not given any acknowledgement or reward, but God had it all in hand, and all this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. So it's written down where the king can come back and read this. Sometimes our efforts seem to be unrewarded, unnoticed, don't they? But I love Malachi 3:16 when it talks about those who fear the Lord and talk to one another and so on. It says, and a scroll of remembrance was written in God's presence concerning those who feared the Lord and honoured his name. So the Lord knows all. The things that we do that nobody else has given any appreciation for at all. And he remembers. I asked the Lord, what was the lesson for me in this, and the lesson for you too? And this is what I believe that he was saying, at least to me, that he has us in the place right now of his choosing, and it's for his purposes. And how will we make the best out of our circumstance and the place that we're in? Esther had no choice, but she made the best of what she had to accept. And despite that lack of choice to live as she wished, there were blessings that came and ultimately the whole life of her people. So will I and will you ask the Lord our Father to take us through the day that he gives us and use the day that he gives us with real faith and confidence, not feeling like we are under the circumstances, we are in them. And God raises us above them. And how often do we fail ourselves and we fail God because we are so negative in our walk with God and understanding what he is doing and can do? So he was saying, leave the woe is me, leave the it can't be done, leave the it's too hard. Since God is for us, who can be against us? Now, we haven't been able to sell our house, you know, and things are getting tougher. The pressure's building up as time goes on. We have no idea where we will be in 6 months' time. Our son has been retrenched where there's closing of offices. The bills for him as well as us don't stop coming in. Employment situations are getting tougher. And I know that some of you have had a lot harder things than that to deal with. Satan's desire was to annihilate the Jews, but God would not and will not let that happen. And no principalities or powers can win over the Lord Jesus Christ in our lives either. Colossians 1:15 says, having disarmed the principalities and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. I love the hymn. Up from the grave he arose with a mighty triumph o'er his foes. And then he poured out his spirit to live within us. So we can live today, we can live each day, and we can do those things while we're looking to him, while we're believing that with peace, with hope, and in fact we can do it with power because he gives us that. Esther's life was mapped out for her. She had a human king to whom she had to bow the knee. We have a king, but he is nothing like Xerxes. The king of love, our shepherd is. And he is the king of kings. And I listened to a Swindle CD and it had a song on it. And it said this, when you do not understand God's purpose and God's plan, in the presence of the king, bow the knee. Because God knows exactly what he's doing, and he's doing it perfectly. And Romans 12:2 says, his will is good and acceptable. We can accept it. It's okay, acceptable and perfect. O Lord, great is thy faithfulness.